The latest edition of the online Issues Etc. journal is out. It contains an article that I've written titled The Theology of Jesus. What's the connection between the Church's Confession of Christ and her Confession of the Trinity? Find out with the latest Issues Etc. journal. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Pastor Mason Beecroft writes about the false promises of Pop American Christianity. Get your copy of the latest Issues Etc. journal by sending your name and email address to journal@issuesetc.org. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. For the next half hour, we'll continue our series on the Christian Crusades, part four of our five-part daily series. Today, we're going to talk about a pope that took the promotion of the Crusades. He actually called for two, only lived to see one, Pope Innocent III. He took it to a whole new level. Joining us to continue our series on the Crusades, Dr. Matt Phillips. You can join us as well, 1-877-623-6943. We are coming to you live this Thursday afternoon, January the 27th, 1-877-623-MY-I-E. Send us an email here in the studio, talkback@issuesetc.org, a tweet @issuesetc, or visit our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Dr. Matt Phillips is a regular guest and associate professor of history at Concordia University, Nebraska. Matt, welcome back.
It's good to be back.
You told us yesterday that Pope Innocent III would take the promotion of the Crusades, kick it up a notch, and
right,
do stuff that no one had ever done before. What did you mean?
Well, let me say a little bit about him that I'll explain a lot. He becomes pope in 1198, so right at the end of the 12th century. He was from an Italian noble family a little bit south of Rome, but he was one of the sons that went into education in the church. So he studied theology in Paris at the what was becoming at that time the University of Paris, Great Center of Theology, in the late 12th century, and then he studied canon law in Bologna, Italy, which was a great center of canon law studies. So he was well-suited to his position. So he gets elected pope at the age of 37 in 1198 with an eye towards really making a big change in society and in the church. And then the papacy had been moving this way towards most of the popes after him were canon lawyers like him. That was an important thing. More administration, stricter control, a better legal control, and so forth. So how did the Crusades come in? Well, we talked about the Third Crusade, how it kind of ended. It ends in the early 1190s, so this is, what, 6 or 7 years later. There were some other misfires in between there, people talking about the Crusades and so forth. So he calls. As soon as he elected in 1198, one of his first things to do is to call a crusade. And he sets out to try to promote that crusade, and that will become the Fourth Crusade. What he ends up doing, particularly after the Fourth Crusade, and we can come back to the specific crusades too, is he tries to incorporate the crusade movement into the church's life. What do I mean by that? He proclaims certain prayers during the times of the year, like during the Mass, we're going to have a litany for the crusade. And he says everybody should be doing this. He has in Rome in the early 1212 or 1211, he has processions in Rome where they process through Rome and they have prayers directed towards the Crusade movement in support of the Crusade movement. So he incorporates the liturgy of the church. He incorporates the Crusade movement into the liturgy of the church itself. Some of the prominent days for that are the festivals of the cross, which was May the 3rd, and the festival that's the invention of the cross. And another one was the Exaltation of the Cross, which many Christians celebrate September 14th. So he kind of revolutionizes the way Crusade is supported, also with taxing the clergy more. Specifically, he brings about what's called the commutation of vows, where I could take a vow to go on Crusade, but then if I really wasn't, like if I was an old lady or somebody who was sick, I could, instead of going on Crusade, I could fund somebody else to go on Crusade, and I would still get the indulgence. So he introduces all these new things to bring more support for the Crusade movement in general.
What is his rationale for the Fourth Crusade? Why does he call it so early in his papacy?
Well, I mean, Jerusalem was still not in Christian hands, and Jerusalem, although we're going to see some other places where they crusade, and we've already seen that in Spain, for instance, Jerusalem is still the most important place. As I said yesterday, after the Third Crusade, they still held some important beachheads, almost literally beachheads, on the Eastern Mediterranean there. But Jerusalem was the goal. I mean, that is where the Holy Sepulchre is. That is the city, right? It is the place, you know, where Jesus was crucified, where he's buried, and where he rose from the dead. So that's the city that's most important, and that's the goal. They're still trying to get Jerusalem back. It was called to get Jerusalem back. They decided to attack. The new plan was, since the main power now controlling Jerusalem was centered in Egypt, the plan was to attack Egypt, knock out the power, and then go north. Because they strategically, they figured, and Richard had known this back during the Third Crusade, even if you take Jerusalem and you don't knock out the power in Egypt, they'll just come up there and cut you off and then take it right back from you. So it was a strategic move. That was the plan, anyway, for the Fourth Crusade. It went way off track.
How was it mounted militarily? Was it the same kind of composition of the knights, the nobility, even kings? And in the last two crusades, I think we talked about, even had the emperor going along at one point.
Right. In the second and the third crusade, you had the Holy Roman Emperor, which was mostly the German-speaking lands go, and the great King of France and King of England in the third crusade. The fourth crusade didn't have any monarchs. It had a lot of dukes and counts. One of the problems was that Richard was still alive when it was called. And Richard and Philip II, the King of France, and Richard, the King of England, had gone back to fighting each other, essentially in Western France. And so Richard told them, well, if you can make Philip, you know, Richard got very indignant when they tried to get him to go on crusade again. He said, well, you're going to have to make my enemy, the King of France, come to heel, or I'm not going. And unfortunately for Richard, he is killed outside of a castle, besieging a castle in France. He was actually just monitoring a siege, and a crossbow killed him from a distance. So that's how he dies. So England is kind of thrown in disarray. John does become king, but he never goes on crusade. Philip isn't going to go on crusade again. So you don't end up either monarch, those two monarchs go, but some of the great counts and dukes of France, and some of England, and there are also some German knights too. But most of the ones that go on what becomes the Fourth Crusade are French. And then you have the Venetians, and the Republic of Venice, who are great sailors. They contract to sail all the crusaders to, and many of them take the cross themselves, to sail to Egypt, to land them in Egypt, essentially have a landing force in Egypt in the Nile Delta, go south, take out Cairo, and then go north to Jerusalem. That was the plan.
So militarily, they need to attenuate the power of Egypt in order to then go get to their main objective, which was Jerusalem, because had they gone straight to Jerusalem without dealing with Egypt, Egypt simply would have come up and said, enough of this. And
strategically, yes. That was what they figured. It was probably correct. There's no reason for us to think that wasn't a good strategy. But the Fourth Crusade, for many reasons, there's my PhD advisor there in St. Louis University, Tom Madden, wrote the book about the Fourth Crusade, so I had to learn a little bit about it for that reason. For a lot of reasons, the Fourth Crusade got blown off course and wildly ends up attacking Constantinople. We probably don't have time to go into all the reasons for that.
Can you put it in a nutshell? I mean, other than the geography, which is remarkable, how they ended up from planning to go to Egypt and then to Jerusalem to take back the Holy Lands from the Muslims, they end up in Constantinople.
Well, some of the people that originally settled on the Fourth Crusade did end up going to the Holy Lands because they got mad along the way things were going. But it was really a series of mishaps from the very beginning. One, the people who contracted with Venice to build this navy, essentially, which they had to build, only ended up showing up with about half as many people as they said they were going to have. So the Venetians have built this twice as big a navy as they needed, and they need to get paid for that. I mean, it costs money. Many of the Venetians also take the cross. They sail the Crusaders. But they kind of make a deal along the way. Well, Venice needs to deal with some of its issues in the Adriatic and the Mediterranean. And they also run upon a fellow who claims that he should be the real Byzantine emperor. And this guy convinces them to go and to essentially reinstate him as emperor in the Byzantine Empire. They were always fighting each other His name was Alexius Angelus, and so he was claiming to go and say, "Look, I need to be restored as the real emperor, and if you do that, I'll give you a bunch of money, and that'll help pay for your for you to go on your way." So they end up going to Constantinople for that reason, and they kind of thought when he showed up, all the people would welcome him. It didn't turn out that way. They end up helping. They end up actually helping him become the emperor, and then he turns on them, the crusader, the Western Crusaders, and that makes them very angry. So then they overthrow him, and by accident, in 1204 almost, they create what becomes known as the Latin Empire that lasts until the 1260s. So from the they overthrow the Byzantine emperor, and from about 1204 to the, I'm going to say the early 1260s, you have what's called the Latin Empire, which was the rulers of the Constantinople were Latin-speaking and connected to the papacy. At first, the papist, Innocent III at the time, is very upset. He excommunicates them one time, or tells him he's going to excommunicate him. Then when he finds out they've conquered Constantinople, he kind of changes his mind and forgives them and said, "Hey, you've brought Constantinople back into the fold of the papacy, so this is God's will, and by accident it's happened." So that's it. I'm sorry, it's probably longer than you wanted, but that's the nutshell of the Fourth Crusade.
Well, it's fascinating. It's fascinating about how the law of unintended consequences, yeah, and then always is governing, of course, along with providence, a Christian history. When we come back, we're going to have 10 more minutes with Dr. Matt Phillips, part 4 of our 5-part daily series on the Crusades. Today we're talking about the Fourth and the Fifth Crusades, and Pope Innocent III. When we come back, he calls for the Fifth Crusade, but he does not live to see it carried out. We'll find out what becomes of the Crusades in the years after Pope Innocent III. Our call-in number, live this Thursday afternoon, January the 27th, 1-877-623-MYIE. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, or a tweet at @issuesetc. We've got nothing against bumper stickers, just bumper sticker theology, and we'd like to send you an Issues Etc. bumper sticker. You'll find the Issues Etc. logo, slogan, and website address. Simply send your request to Lutheran Public Radio, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Please include a self-addressed stamped envelope. Good theology doesn't fit on a bumper sticker, but you can tell people where to find good theology, the Issues Etc. bumper or window sticker.
Did you know that you can listen to Issues Etc. live on most smartphones? Just go to the Listen Live page of our website, issuesetc.org, click the smartphone link, and you can listen on your smartphone weekday afternoons between 3 to 5 Central. Old Theology, New Technology, Issues Etc. now broadcasting live to the world on most smartphones. Issues Etc. issuesetc.org.
Treadmill for the mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you heard of the CLCC? In Hosea 4, we see, "My people are destroyed by lack of knowledge." The Confessional Lutherans for Christ's Commission can help educate Lutherans on being Lutheran. We treasure our Lutheran beliefs and think that all Lutherans would if they learn what we believe, teach, and confess. So visit our website, www.theclcc.org. Check out what we have to offer. Get on our mailing list, or better yet, join us. And maybe encourage your pastor to hold a seminar in your area. Just go to theclcc.org.
The latest edition of the online Issues Etc. journal is out. It contains an article that I've written titled "The Theology of Jesus. What's the connection between the Church's Confession of Christ and her Confession of the Trinity?" Find out with the latest Issues Etc. journal. In the Wittenberg Trail feature, Pastor Mason Beecroft writes about the false promises of Pop American Christianity. Get your copy of the latest Issues Etc. journal by sending your name and email address to journal@issuesetc.org. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for January is called Lutheran Spirituality, Life as God's Child. Some of the subjects covered in this tremendous book: Word, Prayer, Confession, Cross, Witness, Vocation, Community, and Promise. One of the great strengths of this book, in my opinion, is that each chapter ends with a summary of Lutheran teaching on each one of these subjects drawn from the Lutheran Confessions of 1580. It's a tremendous resource. It's called Lutheran Spirituality, Life as God's Child. Find out more about it at our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House. Order Lutheran Spirituality, The Issues, Etc., Book of the Month for January, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Dr. Matt Phillips is our guest. We're in part four of our five-part daily series on the Crusades, talking about Pope Innocent III and the Fourth and Fifth Crusades. There was, before we get to kind of the end of Innocent's life, there was also something called the Albigensian, am I pronouncing that correct, the Albigensian Crusade?
It's quite different. This was a crusade aimed at inside of Europe. That we did have the crusade against the pagans, part of the Second Crusade. This was aimed actually at what they considered to be Christian heretics at the time. So it is a little bit transformative in a way. It's the first major crusade that kind of changes direction. It's not about it's not against Muslims in Spain. It's not about taking Jerusalem back, and it's not about pagans. It's about people who they considered were Christians but had become heretics, what they would call recalcitrant heretics, you know, people who had become. And this group in history is known as the Cathars. There's a big debate right now, actually, among scholars. Some scholars say there really weren't that many Cathars or any at all, and it was kind of a there might have been some people who said some wacky stuff, but they kind of imported these ideas from ancient heresies to them. And then others say there was this basically a shadow Cathar church. Basically, the Cathars were considered to be, by the time, a dualist sect, kind of like the Manichees from the early church, where basically they taught that everything physical is bad and everything spiritual is good. So they were really into fasting and prayer and all this stuff, and they looked very spiritual, but they rejected the incarnation, they rejected the sacraments, and they obviously rejected the authority of the church.
Am I sensing a kind of mission creep here when it comes to the Crusades? Originally, this is about retaining the Holy Land,
right,
and its environs for Christendom. And now by this time, we've got, well, at least in the case of both of those, we have kind of internecine fighting and then also kind of allowing this Fourth Crusade to be hijacked,
yeah,
to be taken against fellow Christians in Constantinople.
Well, and like I said, the Pope along the way is actually sending them letters, you shouldn't be doing this, and he does. I just looked it up in the break to make sure. He does excommunicate them for a time on the way, and then he welcomes them back when they actually take Constantinople. So, you know, hey, because he saw this is an opportunity to actually reunite the church. Now, ultimately what that did was it cemented the schism that began in 1054, and really the Fourth Crusade and that event really cemented the schism between East and West pretty strongly because of the political and military thing. The Albigensian Crusade is fascinating because it was mostly aimed not at the Cathars themselves, but at the people, the knights and nobility of southern France who were perceived to be protecting the Cathars. So a lot of it was aimed at them. It changed the indulgence. Basically, Innocent gives an indulgence for soldiers, for knights and so forth, to go fight in southern France. They get the same indulgence of the remission of sins, but they get you basically get a 40-day indulgence, which means if you go fight for 40 days, obviously if you survive, you get the indulgence because there's no pilgrimage site. You're not going to southern France to pray at the Holy Sepulchre or something, right? You're not coming to Rome to pray at the Pilate Steps or, you know, the Church of St. Peter and Paul or something. So you're just going to fight these heretics in southern France, so it was mostly aimed at those Cathar heretics, or the people who were perceived to be their supporters. Some people picture that as kind of almost like a war in France, like the northern France kind of finally conquering southern France. That's been one way to look at it, too. But I think there were genuine religious beliefs involved in it, too. It is somewhat up to air as to how solid or how real the Cathar heresy was. That is a question among scholars right now that's actually kind of interesting.
Pope Innocent III calls the Fifth Crusade, the so-called Fifth Crusade,
right,
but he does not live to see it carried out.
That's
what
correct.
Occasioned this crusade? What was it supposed to be all about?
This was basically to correct the misfire of the Fourth Crusade, essentially. Obviously, Jerusalem has not been taken back. They still do have some territory in the east, what was still left over. And the Fifth Crusade essentially fulfills what the Fourth Crusade did not do. He caused the Fifth Crusade in 1215 approximately, and he called it a little bit earlier at 1213. It doesn't take off until 1216 or 17. So he calls it around 1213, the papal bull or papal encyclical that goes out to call it. In the meantime, a lot of people that have studied church history, maybe not familiar with the Crusades, the Fourth Lateran Council happens in 1215, which was a huge church council. It was one of the biggest church councils until the Council of Trent, I'd say, right? So a lot of people kind of heard of that one. That's where transubstantiation is usually put as a, quote, dogma of the church. A lot of other issues are brought up. It was a reforming council headed by the Pope. It was his moment. This was the council headed by Innocent III. All the great, you know, all the cardinals and bishops from all over the Western Church are there. And one of the things he does at this council is he preaches the Crusade and says, hey. So a lot of people don't realize that the Crusade was wrapped up into the reform of the church, too. And the Crusade preaching that Innocent begins to encourage, because he had connections to all these theology and social reformers from Paris and other places, they begin to unite Crusade preaching with social reform, like anti-prostitution preaching or anti-usury, anti-greed preaching. And they kind of become united together because God, like we saw with the Third Crusade, God's not going to allow it to be successful unless we're truly penitent. And that's why all those liturgical things begin coming in. All of society has to be reformed, both individually through penance, but also corporately through social, what we would call today social reform, or God will not allow us to be successful. That was the idea. And Innocent really just pushes this heavy.
A quick question from Stephen in Tennessee. He says, there are several recent books out dealing with the Crusades. A controversial new one is by Rodney Stark, God's
right.
Battalions. How do you assess Dr. Stark's thesis, assuming that you have read it or are familiar with it? Another book is Barnaby Rogerson's The Last Crusader, which emphasizes the military aspects of the Crusades. This brings up the question, when did the Crusades transition from being a means to shore up the faltering Byzantine Empire and secure safe passage for Christian pilgrims against Islamic depredations to its becoming a rather conventional military conflict for control of the Mediterranean? Or did it? First, your answer to his first question. We've got about 30 seconds for each.
Okay. The first question is
God's Battalions.
I have not read the second book about is that what you mean?
He wanted to know what you thought about God's Battalions.
Okay. I think that book's pretty good. It's fairly derivative, I would say. Basically, he's trying to give kind of a justification for why the Crusade happened and why it was a just war and so forth. So he gives a lot of arguments as to why that is. Some of the ones we talked about on the first day, I think, for the First Crusade and its origins, about just war theory and all that. A lot of his stuff is derivative from other scholars who are, I'm not putting him down because I thought the book was okay, but a lot of his stuff is derivative from other scholars, names like Jonathan Riley Smith. I noticed he also read Thomas Madden, who I've already mentioned, who I know, and other guys that have done deeper research. And that's fine. I mean, I think his book is okay in that sense. If I remember it correctly, he's basically trying to give a justification for why the Crusades happened, and basically the Christian perspective at the time of just war, they're reacting to Muslim aggression more than being aggressive and so forth. So I don't think the book's, I think the book's pretty good for that reason.
Then with only about 15 seconds, okay. He asks about the transition from this kind of religious.
I'm not sure that's a fair transition or not. I mean, obviously, from what we've been talking about today, some of that's already happening. And but their goal remained Jerusalem in their hearts and in their minds forever. The political situation continued to change. I mean, even with even after the establishment of the Latin Empire, they wanted to take back Jerusalem. Even though we're dealing with heretics in southern France and Muslims in Spain, we want to take back Jerusalem. Ferdinand and Isabella in the 15th and early 16th century, guess what they want to do? They want to take back Jerusalem too. So it remained an idea in people's minds for a long time.
Tomorrow we'll conclude our series on the Crusades with Dr. Matt Phillips. We'll be talking about St. Louis and the Crusades in the 13th century. Dr. Matt Phillips is Associate Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. Matt, it is always a pleasure, and I look forward to the conclusion of our series with you tomorrow.
Me too. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
I find it amazing that, well, this is what happens when there is this marriage of the state's interests, civil interests, and the interests of the church, the body of Christ. What inevitably wins? Politics. Inevitably wins. Of course, that's not a new story. It might be the 12th and the 13th century, but from the time that Christianity is legalized in the Roman Empire, it is a marriage between the civil and the spiritual, and the civil usually ends up getting its way and using the spiritual to its ends. That's the way it's always going to be. That's why the church stands apart as a kingdom that does not wield its authority by the sword, not with the chariot, not with the king's help, not with the emperor's help, even if they want to help. The church does bear a sword, but it is not made of metal. It is none other than the word of God. The church's only power, only authority, and it bespeaks Christ and Him crucified for a world of sinners. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talk with you again tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.